You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy as Visible Speech, Collected Works, Volume 279, translated by Vera and Judy Compton Burnett. This is Lecture 4, entitled The Individual Sounds and Their Combination into Words. I think that in yesterday's lecture, we reached the point at which we were considering the sound R, and I had previously unfolded before you the inner nature of most of the other sounds. It is important, above all, that we should learn to understand the S sound. S, as we learned yesterday, was always looked upon in the mysteries as a sound of the very highest importance. Indeed, it was looked upon as possessing magical qualities. For it can be felt as a sound which brings with it surety and certainty, a feeling of calm, a quietening element. This is induced by the fact that, with the impulse lying behind the sound S, one can penetrate into the inmost nature of another being. For this reason, I said that when a pupil of the old mysteries was asked by someone from the outer world what he had learned through the S sound, he answered, as was customary at that time, in a somewhat humorous vein, and said, "He who is master of the S sound can see into the souls of men and into the hearts of women." There can be no question that in both cases this insight entails the necessity of bringing about a feeling of calm, and this led quite naturally to the humorous use of a sentence such as the one I have described. Now, if in the F sound we have the feeling, "Wisdom lives in me, wisdom created me, I breathe out wisdom, wisdom is ever present within me," then, behind the S sound, we may say that there lies a slight element of fear, something against which we feel we must be on our guard. This is why in those scripts, in which, as I have already told you, the S, or the snail-like curved line, is to be found in the various letters, writing was felt to be something uncanny, something which threw light into hidden depths. And today, using this word, today, in the sense of an historical epoch, certain peoples still exist, though naturally very few, who, unaccustomed as they are to the art of writing, regard the written characters as being distinctly uncanny. When the Europeans, these superior people in quotes of civilization, went to the North American Indians, the North American Indians found much that to them was unpleasant in the ways of these in quotes superior people, and the written characters were among those things which produced in them such an unpleasant sensation. They made it quite clear that in their opinion these pale faces, as they called them, these strange foreign pale faces, conjured little demons, in quotes, on to the paper. And as late as the 19th century, there were certain Indian tribes who still regarded the printed letters as being the embodiment of little demons. Let us consider these two sounds, these two letters, the F and the S. They must be formed in eurythmy in such a way that the onlooker can perceive a tremendous difference between them. When the movement for F is made, it must express the quiet sense of power over that which has been conjured up in the world by its means. The movement is created out of an element of peace. The hands must bend over a little toward the arm, but in an active manner. They must not hang passively, but must be held as if covering something and protecting it. Now, S. You see in the S sound how something is, as it were, moved out of its course with a sense of mastery. The movement was demonstrated. The cause for this feeling really lies in the relationship which arises between the two arms as a result of the movement. Now, let us pass on to sh. One could hardly fail to recognize the blowing past, the blowing away of something, as this is expressed in the sound sh. I made this quite clear to you when I gave as an example the feeling lying behind the word hush hush or whoosh whoosh. The breeze wafts by and passes away, whoosh whoosh. But everywhere in words of an interjectional character, you will observe how this sh sound conveys this feeling of blowing past. There are indeed many words which in this connection are extraordinarily characteristic. You must now consider the deep significance of something which I have already spoken about during these days. I mean the fact that in different languages things are called by different names. The reason for this is that the different languages are really describing different things. For instance, when in German I say the word Kopf, this indicates the form, the plastic form of the head. When, on the other hand, the word testa is used in Italian, it signifies what takes place by means of the head. It signifies a process of corroboration, of affirmation. Thus, the two languages are describing completely different things. That which is called Kopf in German would also be called Kopf in Italian, if the Italian wished to express the same idea. In this way, languages differ very much from each other. When we take the German language, we find that it is of a plastic nature. The genius of the German language is really a sculptor. This must not be overlooked. The peculiar characteristic of the German language is that it is plastic. The genius of the language is a sculptor. The genius of the Latin languages has, on the other hand, something of the lawyer about it, something of the advocate, of one who affirms, confirms, testifies. This is in no way intended as a criticism, but merely as a description of certain characteristics. Each language contains within it the temperament and character of its genius. One may actually carry this so far as to say that when one hears Hungarian, Magyar, or Finnish spoken, one cannot fail to have the feeling that something is really lacking. It is impossible to listen to the Magyar language without feeling that after every third word, something is lacking. When the Hungarian or Magyar language is spoken, one feels that after every third word a stag should be shot. The reason for this is that the genius of the Hungarian language is a hunter. In the Magyar language, all words which have not arisen out of the activity of the hunt are in reality borrowed. The Magyar language has absorbed many such words. And when one arrives in Budapest, one finds at once among the names written up in the streets such strange words as, for example, kavahas. Readers aside, sorry for my pronunciation, end of readers aside, from the German Kaffeehaus, cafe. Such words as these have not, of course, the characteristic I have described. The Magyar language has adopted many such borrowed words. But when one listens to the Magyar language, it is certainly imbued with the element of the hunt, of the chase. Naturally, there is nothing bad about this. The tiller of the soil, the hunter, and the shepherd are invariably the source from which the whole human race has arisen. There still lives a primeval force in such a language as that of the Magyars, and the genius of the Magyar language is undoubtedly a hunter, or, if you will, a huntress, Diana. So we can say, in the German language, we have the plastic formative element. That is a feature which is very much in evidence. For this reason, we find many interjections, which are uncommonly characteristic. Well, it does not even need to be a snake. Even if a restless, agitated mouse is hidden under some leaves, we have already something moving and rolling about, and it gives us an uneasy sensation. We are astonished. R, ah. Now it scampers away. Sh. The feeling of astonishment is not all, however. Something is done to us, but we bear up under it. A. Now, whatever is moving in this way clings to its surroundings. It adapts itself to them, burrows its way through. Where there is a hollow space, it makes its way through, creeping now lower, now higher, L. And when it emerges, then we understand what it is all about, N. Rascheln, to rustle. Here we have the whole story of Rascheln in plastic form. The remarkable feature of the German language is that one can find in it so much that really corresponds to plastic art, that really makes up the plastic element of language. Hence it is, perhaps not without significance, that eurythmy, in the first instance, could most easily arise within the German language, for eurythmy may be said to be sculpture brought into the realm of movement. And it is from out of the German language that this living sculpture can be most easily developed at the present day. In ancient times, all languages possessed a living plastic element. It is true that other languages are more musical in their nature, as is the case, for instance, with the Magyar language. The German language cannot be said to be musical, but for this very reason, the plastic element is all the stronger. And it is just in this word, rascheln, as also in the hush hush, that we have the blowing away, the blowing past, the scattering of something. The Hebrew man of ancient times experienced in the sh, the presence of Jehovah in the blowing of the wind, sh. Naturally, this also may be felt as lying behind the plastic eurythmic movement for the sound, sh. The movement must be rapid. Then it has the true rustling effect, rascheln, and really gives the feeling that is expressed in the word. It is no exaggeration to say that one actually hears the rustling in the form of the movement. Yesterday I spoke to you also about the way in which the sound Z is to be understood. I said then that there is a certain lightness in the experience of Z, and this experience, together with its plastic, eurythmic expression, is derived from this feeling of lightness, from something which is essentially light. Thus, when we turn our attention to Z, we shall regard it in much the same way as one might do a child, who, having lost a new toy which has been bought for it, cries and is inconsolable. One would not wish to scold the child, but to comfort it. Let us suppose that it is not the mother or the father who is dealing with the child, but an aunt or grandmother, whose manner toward the child, who has been up to some mischief, is aunt-like or grandmotherly. The gesture, especially with the right hand, suggests, "Never mind, little one. It would be quite good if we were to bear such little The gesture, especially with the right hand, suggests, "Never mind, little one. It would be quite good if we were to bear such little stories in mind. You must feel the Z, more especially in the arm, not in the wrist, but in the downward movement of the arm." Up to now, my dear friends, we have mainly considered the nature of the individual sounds as such. At this point, it will be necessary for us to discover the right way of expressing the connection between the sounds. And in order to lead over, gradually, into this somewhat different sphere, I shall from time to time take the opportunity of making certain observations. As occasion offers, I shall deviate from the purely artistic side of eurythmy and refer to educational and also to curative eurythmy. Thus, when I pass over to educational eurythmy, you will see how this aspect of eurythmy must be derived from the inner nature of the sounds, as we have studied them in these lectures. It is quite obvious that in the beginning, when teaching the movements, one should, as far as possible, choose words expressing a definite mood or feeling, so that one enters into the spirit of eurythmy by means of the feeling contained in the sounds. And by this means we are able to conjure up a right attitude toward eurythmy, a realization that eurythmy is a language, a a language which may indeed be understood if only approached without prejudice. Now everything is contained for us in this word Rascheln, if you make the movement as clearly as possible and with great precision. Only you must never lose sight of the fact that it is not the external process only which is of importance, but that the movements must be permeated by feeling. When this word is shown now in Eurythmy, I shall be able to tell you what is really contained within it, just at one particular point, and then you will indeed perceive what is hidden in this word. The word was demonstrated. Now, for instance, the person who has been disturbed by the rustling pokes his nose in the direction from which it comes. So you see, when we take into account the subjective element of feeling, we find that absolutely everything is contained in eurythmy. We will now take another very characteristic word. You will remember my description of the sound ts. K is similar but stronger. In the sound K, we have matter governed, mastered by spirit. Suppose for a moment that you are confronted by a regular termagant, by somebody who appears all physical strength and of whom you are somewhat afraid. It is not easy to deal with such a person, but although you have to brace yourself against his behavior, you nevertheless wish to get rid of him, to, as it were, blow him away. You say to him then, but in eurythmy, kush. In this word you have every possibility of feeling these things. There is the repulsing of the person in question, the feeling of gathering oneself together in order to confront him. But there is also the mastery over him. In practicing the word, do it in such a way that you have a very clear sh at the end. For the pacifying element in the word kush lies in the fact that one intends to get rid of something. Now, in teaching eurythmy, it is important to choose those words in which one can, on the one side, still feel the plastic formation of the sounds, and on the other side, the inner life that is thereby developed. Now, these sounds make up in themselves the separate elementary parts of eurythmy as a whole. From these parts, words are then put together. When, in a word, let us say, for instance, the word Rascheln, you simply make the sounds in an intellectual manner, one after another, the result will not be a word, in the true sense. It is an undeniable fact that a word is much more of a complete whole than one usually thinks. If this were not so, we, as speaking human beings, could never have become so dried up and lifeless as we unfortunately are. When we read aloud, we do not read the individual sounds quite distinctly. We glide over the whole word and only touch lightly upon the single sounds. The one sound passes over into the other, and in ordinary speech also, the one sound passes over into the next. In eurythmy, therefore, we must not only pay particular attention to the forming of the single sounds, but, above all, to the movement which expresses the transition from sound to sound. A word can only become beautiful in eurythmy if one succeeds in obtaining a natural transition from one sound to the next. And so it becomes necessary to turn our attention to the way in which one sound proceeds out of the other. One should try to discover how this takes place, and for this reason it is good to take characteristic words, which occur very often, practicing them, not so much from the point of view of the individual sounds, but as a whole. Take, for instance, the word und, and the simple word und, and try to show it in one continuous, unbroken movement. Try, before you have quite finished the u sound, to begin the n. This lends itself very well to eurythmy. Before the movement for U is really completed, let it pass over into N, U-N, and from this immediately make the transition into the D, UNT. From a study of eurythmy, it is really possible to discover the inner intentions of the genius of language. I told you that D is the indicating movement. This is shown clearly in eurythmy. Now, how does the word und end? It ends with D, with the indicating movement. What purpose does the word und really serve? We say, for instance, sun and moon. There is the sun, we turn from the sun to the moon, indicating the moon by means of the and. Thus, through eurythmy, one is able to rediscover the primeval gestures underlying speech. All this must be felt and experienced. Bearing this in mind, let us take a word that even in the German language has long lost its plastic form, which, however, it once possessed to a very high degree. When I say once, that does not mean centuries ago. I refer to a not so very distant past. At that time, this word had a plastic form. It is true that the word, as we now know it, is comparatively modern, but as it emerged from the dialect, it still had its plastic character. And as dialect, it still retains this character today. As I said before, we must not allow our feeling for such things to be disturbed by a philology which in its own place is fully justified. Let us take this German word, Mensch, human being, and let us express it in eurythmy, somewhat shortening the final sh sound, Mensch. Here we have a distinct feeling of the blowing past at the end of the word. How do the eurythmy movements for this word affect us? They give us the impression of the transience of human life. They give us a picture of the fleeting nature of man. Carrying this somewhat farther, we are shown the insignificance of the human being. This is what the eurythmic gestures say to us when showing the word Mensch as a whole. Now, in dialect, the word Mensch signifies a woman of completely trivial character. The word is not used in any bad sense, but simply indicates a woman who is quite uninteresting, das Mensch. Here the element of insignificance is strongly emphasized, and the tragic conception which one has regarding der Mensch is carried further and colored with contempt when one says das Mensch. Thus, in the plastic gestures and movements of eurythmy, we have the possibility of learning to feel deeply the meaning and true nature of words. There is one thing, however, about which we must be perfectly clear. Eurythmy, by means of the sounds which make up the different words, necessarily leads us into the inner nature of that to which the sounds themselves refer. When you see words for apparently the same thing shown in eurythmy, you will nevertheless perceive, by the character of the movements, the difference in the character of the words. Will Fräulein B and Fräulein W now stand side by side, and we will ask Fräulein B first to show the word Kopf, and afterward Fräulein W will show Testa. Now, with the word Kopf, you have the feeling that the eurythmist wishes to form something round, wishes to be a sculptor. The eurythmist who is showing the word testa is determined to be in the right. In this way you see visibly expressed the essential characteristics of any particular word. These things must be borne in mind. Then you will discover how, through eurythmy, the character of the different languages is revealed in a most subtle and marvelous way. You can feel how the character of the different languages rises up, as it were, before your very eyes. In order that this may be more fully illustrated, let us now see a German, an English, a French, and possibly also an Hungarian and a Russian poem interpreted in eurythmy, in such a way, moreover, that by emphasizing as far as possible all the sounds, the character of the poem in question is clearly shown. Parenthesis. The poems were then demonstrated by representatives of the different nations. Close parenthesis. You will at once perceive how, for instance, the English language reveals its connection with the waves of the sea. And the mastery of the waves, which lies so strongly in the English language, comes out extraordinarily clearly in eurythmy. in the Magyar language, the feeling, the mood which is brought to expression, is that the Magyar can only picture himself as being planted firmly on the earth and having to roam through thicket and forest. This too you can see in the interpretation of the Magyar poem. Russian, again, is a language which is merely suggestive, which only gives a faint indication of the inner nature of the word. It is a language which has not yet its true being, but is following the tracks leading it toward this being, and is pointing on all sides toward the future. And now I should like you to compare two things which will give you an insight into the marked way in which this difference of character reveals itself. One must learn to feel this, otherwise one cannot find one's way into the nature of eurythmy. A purely theoretical, intellectual explanation will not suffice. We must be led to a true feeling and understanding of what eurythmy really is. Let us then compare the eurythmic interpretation of a Russian poem with that of a French poem. Try to realize the great contrast between the two. The Russian poem was here demonstrated. Now, with the Russian poem, you see how one follows on the tracks of the word. And try now with the other poem, the French poem, to observe how there is, as it were, even in front of a word, a tripping away from it. The French poem was then demonstrated. Here there is the feeling of always being in front of the word. You see, these two languages may really be compared to day and night, to the opposite poles. Their characteristics are so different. When you consider all these things, which are really quite apparent, you will feel bound to say, in eurythmy there is the possibility of bringing clearly to expression the living spirit which is embodied in language, and above all the character of the language. For this reason, eurythmy is particularly well fitted to express all that lies behind language, and one must, of course, be able to express what lies behind language. In this connection, we will take our start from something quite definite. We differentiate, when we speak in this way, between abstract words, words which indicate the abstract, and words which indicate the concrete. The point is that with words indicating something abstract, the play of feeling is quite different from concrete words. If one has an unprejudiced, lively perception, if one is neither a frog nor a fish, and without being either frog or fish, listens to speech, then one has, in the case of an abstraction, the feeling of being hollowed out, of becoming empty. One becomes inwardly glacial when one hears abstractions. Naturally, one must cultivate a sensitiveness for this. One should, for example, even develop sensitiveness for things which, when uttered, must be said to sound paradoxical. But whoever will live into language, and thereby into eurythmy, in an artistic way, he must be able to form just such sensitive inner perceptions. People read Kant. Now, you are all educated people, and you know, do you not, even if you have not read Kant yourselves, what a figure one must make of oneself if one reads Kant. Mit heit er kite. Well, why does this strike you as so humorous? Readers aside, excuse me, I think that in the parenthesis the actual first word is English, mirth, and then the German of that is heit er kite. End of readers aside. You think one can't do that? I will prove to you at once that one can do it quite adequately. It is only so disagreeable to read Kant in the town or in a reading room or lecture room. He does not fit in here. But try just once, when it is really cold, to read Kant on Mont Blanc, and you will see at once how adequate this is. Isn't it so? When you begin Kant, it is abstract. When you end Kant, it is abstract. If you actually read him in the icy atmosphere, there he fits in admirably. He fits in there. If you can think of such a thing, there the feeling is out and out suited to the abstract. The concrete must not be read on Mont Blanc, but this must be read or spoken by the warm stove. This does not hollow one out, but one is replenished. And there's a diagram. And now just try. In a connection in which something must be conceived as abstract, really to indicate the abstraction, let us first show an abstract word. Naturally, all this is relative, for what is abstract for one person can be very concrete for another. But now, let us take something very abstract, and you indicate for us the gestures, the movement, that is to say, for the abstraction in general. We will suppose, for example, that in some connection there appeared the word, in quotes, triangle, and you wanted to show its abstraction. You must do this in such a way, there's this diagram, that if this is background and this foreground, this movement would appear, parenthesis, the movement was stepped in space, close parenthesis. You take on yourself the unpleasant task of hollowing something out. You build, as it were, if I express myself in a drastic manner, the front part of a barrel, so that you have not got the wine in front of you, but behind you, so that you cover it. The front part of a barrel makes the abstraction. Now, make the concrete, let us say, for example, frog or fish, anything we like, for everything is concrete that can be seen. Now, the essential nature of the concrete is this movement. And again, there's a diagram. When you do this movement, then you can give the impression that you have the wine in front of you. You take it into your care. You feel in yourself that which represents replenishment. Suppose we wished to show in Eurythmia a strong feeling of affirmation. The young man leaves his parents' house. They declare, as he bids them farewell, that he will come back again. "You will come back to us again," says the father. Try now to express in Eurythmia this phrase, "You will come back to me again." And in doing so, show clearly the feeling of affirmation. How do we express this? By a step. When we wish to affirm something, we take a step forward, toward the right, and in this step there must be the feeling, as it were, of the E sound, of assertion. Thus affirmation is expressed by a movement of the foot from the back forward. Negation, let us suppose that somebody tells a child he is not to do something, "You must never do that again." If you wish to emphasize this feeling of negation, you must do so by taking a step backward toward the left. These things are, of course, quite elementary. Thus we can pass over from what is revealed as to the nature of the single word to the inner logic which is contained in language. And in this way the character of the language becomes still more evident. If one considers the single sound as such, when expressing a poem in Eurythmia in any language, then the character of the language is emphasized. When, on the other hand, we take into consideration things which we shall be studying presently, when we pass over to logic, as it is expressed in language, then more emphasis is laid on the character of the people. Let us pass over now to this logic of language, and to begin with, take the feeling of wonder. When a passage occurs in which the feeling of wonder is expressed, you will make the movement for wonder, parenthesis, movement for ah, close parenthesis, and you must merge the movement in with the other sounds, so that both mood and sounds are shown. Much study is required before one succeeds in expressing the succession of sounds, together with the indication of the logic of language, of the emotional content. Ach, wie schön! Parenthesis, oh, how beautiful, close parenthesis. Try here to put the two things together, the movement for wonder and the sounds contained in the words, ach, wie schön. The movement expressing wonder must be united with the actual single sounds. Wonder must lie in the formation of the sound. Tomorrow we will analyze other similar movements. And there's a footnote. According to feeling and mood, other vowels might, of course, also be chosen to add color to the whole. These would likewise have to be blended in with the actual succession of sound. The end of Lecture 4.